Thank you for having me here, and thanks for the invitation. I last spoke at the ARSC conference in 2006, I think it was, in Seattle, where I was infuriated with the fact that I had to come to speak to a group of people who collect sound recordings about how copyright law is getting in your way. And we were focusing at that time on issues of fair use, and it was my hope that by 2012, these issues would have at least been further along, or at least we'd have some resolution. So I have an unusual beginning to my talk here by saying that I am angry that I still have to be here. I will immediately indicate that I have a bias. My bias is that I fail to see the rationale for copyright law getting in the way with the work of archives, collectors, particularly those who collect sound recordings that don't have a ready market. Meaning, there isn't much money lost, or if there is money lost by the entertainment industry, there's no empirical data to suggest what that money might look like. Either way, unfortunately, I am here today to talk to you about what's happening not only on the domestic stage, but on the international stage in copyright law. And I should say additionally that I am an IP professor and former practitioner. I practice at a couple of firms in Manhattan. I was also a resident fellow and now affiliate scholar with the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. And I am not anything more than an amateur music collector. I recently set up a old 33, basically a cheap turntable with whatever records I had left from my collection. So I spin 33s, primarily 50s and 60s. I am not a musicologist in the sense that most of the people here are. What I am, however, is a concerned IP lawyer and professor, and for that reason, I'm happy to talk to you today. Although my hope is that 5 years from now, you're gonna be able to say, we've heard enough about that and those issues are moving along nicely. We can get back to the more fun stuff. So with all of that, if you still wanna stay, what am I gonna talk about here? We have four acronyms up on the slide there, and I guess most people in the room, I'm sure, have heard of SOPA and PIPA and perhaps been involved beyond having just heard of it. But I'm curious, how many people in the room by a show of hands has heard of ACTA? Okay. And I see about three or four. And how about TPP? And what if I add Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement? Does that change any answer? Now, I'm not at all surprised by that, and so I'm here to partially sound a clarion call with regard to why you should be aware of what's going on with these agreements, and what I'm going to do is talk about ACTA and TPP, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, and a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement with reference to SOPA and PIPA. And what I'm going to talk about more broadly is both a procedural problem as well as a substantive problem. My purpose here primarily is to tell you not only why you should care about what's going on in these arenas, but also why you, despite caring, may not have the ability to offer any meaningful input to those who are actually creating these laws. So I start with anger, and now I add futility to the topic of my discussion today. But hopefully, again, there'll be an upside at the end of it all. Being familiar, and I'll assume a certain level of familiarity with SOPA and PIPA, SOPA and PIPA and the protests particularly that occurred in the wake of them, and I, again, by way of disclaimer, I was involved in those on the writing side, on the advocacy side, indicated that there's an increasing awareness that we should, as a society, and in fact legislators should, understand the difficulty of regulating the internet. And this goes back to its initial inception as a commercial medium. As I wrote in a letter to Congress that I co-authored with Professors Mark Lemley at Stanford and David Post of Temple this past July, which was subsequently published in a Stanford Law Review online, and that's where you can find the edited version of it, we said the approach taken in PIPA has grave constitutional infirmities. At least what we think would be the current PIPA has potentially dangerous consequences for the stability and security of the internet addressing system and will undermine U.S. foreign policy and strong support for free expression on the internet and around the world. That letter indicated the challenges that I think, again, the members of ARSC are merely in the middle of, and perhaps caught in the middle of. The challenges regulating the internet are issues not just of personal security, but also of national security. And indeed, national security has become the prism through which copyright law at the international level is being considered. So you did not expect, perhaps, to hear about national security concerns here, but now you're going to, because copyright law is thought in those terms, and I'll explain in a little more detail in a moment. But regulating the internet also involves issues of globalization, as we know, and communication through free media between peoples who, prior to the advent of the internet, had no pervasive way to communicate with each other. And so, what we've seen at the international level with both ACTA and TPP is quite alarming. ACTA, to give you a jumping right ahead, is supposed to be, and supposed to create, a new international framework for combating online piracy. And over 40 countries, including all the members of the EU, have been involved in the negotiations. Those negotiations began, we think, in October of 2007. They have been concluded, and right now there's a process going on to either kill ACTA or ultimately have it pass through the EU, where the current battleground is. For most of the time during which ACTA was negotiated, the public had absolutely no access to negotiating drafts or any information regarding what the negotiating parties were actually doing. TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, involves 9 countries, including the United States. The United States Trade Representative, or the USTR, as I'll refer to him throughout this talk, is currently ongoing right now negotiating the TPP, largely behind closed doors, in Dallas. Again, the public has no access to negotiating drafts. And in fact, we don't really know what's being negotiated because there's been one leak of an IP chapter of TPP that is now over a year old, and therefore we don't know whether it's still accurate. That is a sum and substance of all of the concrete information we have about the TPP, and yet, as I'll talk about in a moment, you will be impacted if the TPP becomes law, and indeed if ACTA becomes enforceable. And with that, we can think about a couple of ways to think about these problems, some observations. Larry Lessig, in an early iteration of his book Code, pointed out the value of transparency and the difference between open code and closed code. And he said something which, again, seems self-evident but becomes increasingly important in the creation of IP law. Secret laws are not law. Closed code hides its systems of control, and open code cannot. Any system built into open code that is transparent to those who can read the code, just as lawyers are transparent to those who can read Congress's code, lawyers. What is the purpose of raising this initial point? It is to emphasize that the way we are creating law currently at the international stage involving IP is the epitome of closed code. It is, in fact, for all intents and purposes, secret law. And how does that happen? Okay. Again, my primary goal here is to raise the alarm bell or at least make you aware of these issues so that you know a little bit more about what's going on. The Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, has a national security exemption, and that national security exemption deals with issues that are specifically authorized under an executive order and are properly classified that way. Now, if you think about national security issues, what might they be? And there are logical examples of national security issues. Through the current executive order, and again, speaking to a room primarily of not lawyers, an executive order is what it sounds like. It's a presidential order that has, practically speaking, the force of law, although if there were a group of law professors in the room, they would start arguing with me about it. But for our purposes, that sums it up. What does the executive order, the current executive order in place, describe as national security information? Military plans, weapon systems or operations, foreign government information, and that is where international IP law is currently classified as involving foreign government information. Intelligence activities, including covert actions, foreign relations, arguably also part of this, okay, scientific, technological, or economic matters relating to national security, U.S. government programs for safeguarding nuclear materials or facilities, vulnerabilities or capabilities of systems and so forth relating to national security, and the development, production, or use of weapons of mass destruction. Let me be clear. If you made a Freedom of Information request to the federal government asking for any of those categories of information, you would be told, no, you cannot have access to that information because it is national security information. Based upon how current international IP laws being created, we can add a fictitious, to be clear, but I think relevant, additional example of national security information, that being the U.S. international negotiating position regarding how to deal with copyright piracy of Adele's Grammy Award-winning album, 21, okay? And let me be clear about this, because that's obviously a high-profile example. But you could put, and I did skim the presentations that are coming up during the conference, and I wish I could attend many of them. In fact, to be clear, I will not physically be here, so I haven't chosen which ones I would. But those same concepts, those same areas that you're going to be speaking about over the next 3 days would also fall under national security concerns of the United States. So that's where we are, okay? And again, this would be a pretty boring presentation if we debated whether the public should have access, for example, to how to produce and use weapons of mass destruction coming from the U.S. government. But we should have a debate about whether IP law should be treated the same way, whether the creation of IP law should be treated for purposes of transparency and accountability, that is, to be clear, your access information, the same way request regarding matters of national security or safeguarding nuclear materials are, okay? How does this play out? And I'll tell you very quickly, all right? If you look at a draft ACTA FAQ, okay, a frequently asked question document that was produced by the U.S. Trade Representative, ironically through a Freedom of Information request, where the request was, and this request was made by Knowledge Ecology International, which I commend to you as one organization to follow these issues. They made a Freedom of Information request asking the U.S. Trade Representative to tell the public what their position was on transparency regarding ACTA. And what came back was a draft document. Okay, to be clear, this was a draft, but the way that the USTR has handled transparency, that is secrecy, through ACTA suggests that this question and answer is in fact how the USTR has thought about these issues. The question was, what if US positions evolved during negotiations? What should be the response to that question from the public by the USTR? And the proposed response was, the public can see how the U.S. position has evolved when the final text is signed, okay? Again, I'm not making this up, okay? This to me, when I read it the first time, was gallows humor, and I thought, well, that's just funny. I mean, that's a good line, I'll use, you know. No, that is in the draft document. So that has been how the USTR has viewed transparency with regard to ACTA. Similarly, with regard to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, again, a leak. The only information we have regarding negotiations has come from leaks, indicates that the USTR is treating the IP chapter, and the TPP, to be clear, covers a variety of areas, not just intellectual property, but the intellectual property chapter is viewed as foreign government information that therefore cannot be disclosed to the public. And again, notice that second bullet. For 4 years from entry into force of the agreement, or if no agreement enters into force, 4 years from the close of the negotiations. So again, to be clear, if TPP never actually becomes enforced, the public will not be able to know what was negotiated for 4 years afterwards. So these are the positions that the USTR has taken. And the concern is, again, that the public, at least in my view, should have more information than it does about these issues. Okay? In fact, the nerds, as identified through the SOPA and PIPA debates, the nerds need to be brought into the room. The nerds need to be part of the discussions. Precisely because the internet is not just a medium for sharing commercially valuable information and content created by Hollywood, but in fact is much broader than that. And monolithic views regarding how the internet should be run from any perspective is antithetical to how the internet was actually designed. For those of you that are interested in the history of the internet, I commend to you a book by Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and Harry Lewis, who wrote a book, Blown to Bits, a few years ago. And some of you may be familiar with them because they've been heavily involved in Creative Commons. They said, with regard to the history of how the internet was created, a very, I think, enlightening point. They said the entire social structure in which internet protocols evolved prevented special interests from gaining too much power or building their pet features into the internet infrastructure. That is how the internet was in fact envisioned, and yet today we don't quite have that ideal. So, the defining characteristic of the internet
exists today because the internet has been built and has largely been operated in its best incarnations as an infrastructure devoid of special interests-based speech restrictions, okay? Why is this all relevant to SOPA, PIPA, ACTA, and TPP? We have these laws being created as well, or potentially being created, as well as the copyright alert system, the graduated response systems, all being built largely without nearly the amount of public input from those other than the entertainment and pharmaceutical industries regarding what the balance should look like. Now, SOPA and PIPA, compared to ACTA and TPP, are models of good government. In fact, because we have access to actual bills, we are doing far better on the domestic side. So it's important to think about these issues from the international perspective, okay? Again, I can talk more about this in the question and answer session, but with regard to how decision makers should think about these issues, I firmly believe, and it certainly serves the interest of archivists, librarians, educational institutions, and so forth, that the value of the internet as being one built not around special interests, but around collective interest, needs to be protected. And in fact, that interest protects all who use the internet. There are plenty of laws on the books, and people in this room know them quite well, including the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and its well-known notice and takedown provisions, that allow those allegedly wronged by speech, okay, that is copyright infringement, to seek relief without, as me and my co-authors wrote in July, breaking the internet. If you think about the legal standards around copyright law in the United States and compare them to what TPP may look like and what ACTA, in fact, will look like, we see a much better system existing at the domestic level than we will with international law being created this way. And to be clear, if ACTA and TPP come into force, they will impact U.S. domestic law, not to mention the countries, foreign countries who signed those agreements. Grokster's, for example, substantial non-infringing use standard, enmeshed with the inducement idea, ensnared Grokster, okay, which even those who are favorable to fair use recognize was not a good actor. And in fact, it would likely capture current piracy websites. Cyberlockers, right, entities that allow you to store files, okay, Dropbox and so forth, are responding to charges against Mega Upload, the well-known Dropbox site that, if those of you who didn't follow this story, was shut down through a joint effort of U.S. and New Zealand criminal authorities who went after a guy who was making millions doing what is absolutely copyright infringement and piracy, that is wholesale copying verbatim of sound files and other files and then selling them or allowing their distribution. Cyberlockers have responded to the recent prosecution of Mega Upload by tightening their policing of and storage of infringing content. We have the Department of Justice, the executive branch, the Department of Homeland Security, okay, having entities, individuals, and offices dedicated to going after the very piracy that is the putative target of SOPA, PIPA, ACTA, and TPP. And we have what is going to be rolled out over the coming few months with, again, minimal public input, the copyright alert system, graduated response, giving people private warnings when, in fact, content owners think that there is, in fact, infringement occurring. All of this is happening or has happened. All of this is law. And yet, we are seeing at the international level, the U.S. Trade Representative representing the interests of the United States, apparently, pushing for international law that would create more rather than less ways to go after not just pirates, but in fact many of the people that do the work in this room, okay? So, where are we, okay? As we said in this letter, in this article I've referred to, a right to insist, for example, on the removal of content from the global internet, regardless of where it may have originated or be located, in services of the exigencies of domestic law and interest is precisely what we should not be doing right now, okay? So, what is the real problem that happens here? Why is this law being created this way? Now, I could just give you views with regard to capture, right, the idea of lobbying. But I'm going to go beyond that and talk about what would happen if we had actual transparency and accountability and public input. Because I will tell you that despite everything I've just said, I don't think most of the people doing these negotiations actually want to do the wrong thing. I think, in fact, that if the information is actually shared and gotten to the right people, and the right people meaning people like the USTR, we can get better law. So what we want to think about is how we can get to that point, okay? There are, for example, apparently, discussions ongoing between the technology and content industries about how to address online piracy, despite the fact that SOPA and PIPA, as far as we know, are dead, okay? And yet, while those negotiations are going on, the MPAA's current chairman, Chris Dodd, said famously, with regard to the concern about the lack of support for SOPA and PIPA, among many former friends, apparently, of the MPAA, I'm not going to go into more detail with regard to the ongoing negotiations, because obviously if I do, it becomes counterproductive. It becomes counterproductive to have those discussions publicly. So how can we handle these issues, okay? We have currently a system that allows for IP law at the international level to be treated as a national security concern, okay? ACTA is being negotiated as a national security concern, and TPP is being negotiated as a national security concern. So what do, okay? If we think about these issues a bit more, okay, we know that transparency and accountability and public input might be helpful. And there are countless examples of a disparity there. This is an email that was sent to a number of people who focus on international IP law issues by Sean Flynn of American University School of Law, Program of Information Justice and IP. They have a website called InfoJustice, if you're interested, again, in following these issues, about having been at a recent TPP negotiation round, having set up merely a room like this to allow any negotiators to come in and hear a position, and being told, well, you have to cancel that event because apparently there was a USTR-sponsored and supported private tour of 20th Century Fox Studios led by a member of Fox's governmental relations staff. Again, lobbying is fine, okay? People having a voice at the table, fine. The same entities, however, who are hosting this tour also have privileged access to information about what ACT and TPP actually looks like through an arcane but important process called ITACs, or Industry Trade Advisory Councils, which are councils made up of various industry members, depending on the industry, that advise the USTR. It may not come as any surprise to anyone in this room that the ITAC, that's the acronym, the ITAC for IP, is made up exclusively of lobbyists and others from the content and pharmaceutical industries. There is no representation from anyone else, including the public, or anyone else that might have another view. And so those ITACs have allowed for a tiered access to information. Whereas the public cannot see draft texts, the members of the ITAC can. So the members of the ITAC can see what is actually being negotiated and offer input, whereas the public cannot, okay? All of this means, right, we're going to have poorly drafted and imbalanced law. And this is a quote taken from the hearings involving SOPA and PIPA, which I think sums it up well. Recall in SOPA and PIPA, there was a lot of debate regarding how, again, websites could be removed from the internet for all intents and purposes, and what that would do to the domain name system, which is the system that allows you to type google.com into an address bar and get to Google. And Representative Chaffetz pointed out there's a problem, and let's take our time. Let's bring the nerds in and get this right. And by nerds, he was referring to literally computer engineers, people who would actually be able to describe the technology involved. The nerds, in fact, did come into the room with regard to SOPA and PIPA, and in fact, the sponsor of SOPA in the House, Representative Smith, after hearing from the nerds, okay, i.e. 75 or so internet engineers who pointed out the problems, said, well, maybe this domain name system provision is a bad idea and we'll remove it, okay? So there's an example of input actually working. Again, to be clear, there is no ability for the public, anyone in this room, to offer that same input to the U.S. Trade Representative because we don't have access to the text. And what does this mean for example, TPP? from what we know based upon leaked, again, portions of the TPP, and I'll give you an example here, okay, and this gets into a pretty detailed copyright law, but again, incredibly relevant to the people in this room. The current, well, I shouldn't say current, the only draft we have of the IP chapter, which may or may not be accurate today, indicated that each party to this agreement shall provide that authors, performers, and producers of phonograms have the right to authorize or prohibit all reproductions of their works, performances, and phonograms in any matter or form, permanent or temporary, including temporary storage in electronic form. And phonogram, for our purposes, is literally representations of sounds and so forth. Now, what does all that mean? For those of you that are more familiar with copyright law, you know that one of the requirements for actually creating a case of copyright infringement is fixation, okay? Having a work fixed. And until the advent of the internet, there was a really unanalyzed and almost irrelevant portion of the definition of fixation that suddenly became very relevant with the internet. Fixation must be, okay, in a medium for more than a transitory duration. Now again, this will emphasize when I explain this very quickly why you need to have the nerds in the room, whether at the international or domestic stage. More than a transitory duration, okay, can mean anything from surfing the web, which literally allows you to have a copy of a web page in your computer for a second or two, to having something on paper. But if we have in TPP the phrase, and that's that parenthetical there, including temporary storage in electronic form, what that means, okay, it seems quite clearly, what that means is that the proposal in TPP includes the concept that merely surfing the web supports a claim for prima facie copyright infringement, because a transitory duration, okay, can be something as little as 1.2 seconds. And 1.2 comes from a few cases that I won't bore you with now, but I'm happy to talk about in more detail in question and answer. This standard, okay, has been criticized widely by a wide variety of people. In fact, a recent opinion in the Second Circuit, the Federal Appellate Court, pointed out that this could be a problem. TPP apparently is codifying the most restrictive definition of fixation that you could possibly envision today. One that could lead to, again, to be clear, the basic idea of surfing the web being copyright infringement, meaning that you'd have to then use a defense like fair use to protect yourself. Now, you might say, well, what are the chances of being sued for surfing the web? And I'll say for the average consumer, probably not. But if I'm looking for ways to go after an entity that I think may not be using my copyrighted works the way I would like them to use it, it would be helpful to know that I don't have to worry about fixation, because I know that temporary storage in electronic form meets the definition. Okay? Arcane, somewhat detailed stuff, absolutely. And again, I started the talk by saying that I'm angry that I have to have this discussion, and that anger derives from the fact that I had to explain fixation to you, okay, on something that really should not be debatable. Okay? Having said all that, that's, yes. Oh, okay, thank you. Having said all that, let me now go down the parade of horribles with regard to TPP, which again is currently being negotiated. That's not all. Again, based upon the leaked draft, I keep giving that caveat, but I'll stop now. TPP codifies the U.S.'s current definition of the duration of copyright. Okay, there is no fair use proposal in anything that's ever been leaked by anyone involving TPP. So the fair use defense to copyright infringement is not in TPP as far as can be told. The idea expression dichotomy is not there as well, nor is the first sale doctrine. The specific exemption, by that I mean the statutory exemption that exists in U.S. copyright law under Section 108 for library and archives or for educational institutions in Section 110, is not there as well. And what that means, again, to be clear, the U.S. is going to its negotiating partners, putting forward a proposal for how international IP law should look that does not include most, apparently, of the balances that we have against excessive use of copyright law, okay? Fair use, of course, being the cardinal example of that, okay? So that's TPP. All of this means you need to be concerned, okay? And my purpose here is merely to raise this specter. Because of the secrecy around the negotiations, tomorrow, although I don't expect this to happen, the USTR could decide we're going to make the agreement public, and we could find that there's a fair use defense in it. But as we stand right now, we don't know, and more importantly, you don't have the ability, as literally the experts, to be clear that the USTR needs to hear from. The USTR doesn't need to hear from more copyright lawyers like me. It needs to hear from collectors, from archivists, from librarians who can tell them specifically, this is what the law does to us. Okay? And because you don't have the ability to do that, not just because you may not be a lawyer, but because you can't see the text, we have a fundamentally flawed process on the international stage. What I urge you to do, okay, and it's the main thing you can do, is merely read up on these issues, okay? InfoJustice is a good website to go to. Knowledge Ecology is another. Public Knowledge. These are all advocacy organizations, more or less, although InfoJustice is part of an academic institution, but they will give you at least an update to where we stand. Ultimately, again, my concern is balance in the law. Not having perfect copyright law for one side or the other, but having balance. Right now, clearly, we will not have that, and we don't have it. And the impact on this area, literally the topics that you talk about here, could be grave unless the public has a right to offer input, and then we might have a shot to get some balance into international law. And on that quasi-positive note, I'll thank you for having me here.